Good morning, Commissioners. Thanks, everybody, for joining us here today. I'd like to, I know we're already a little bit behind schedule, and I'd like to tell you that I'm going to be able to help you catch up, but I doubt that's going to be the case. Have a fairly lengthy director's report this morning. Obviously, I think everybody realizes we've got a lot of things going on, we're working hard to keep up with them. In some cases, we are keeping up with them. In some cases, maybe not so much. And we've got a lot of challenges for the agency on the horizon, maybe more so than any time that I can remember, except for the extreme budget shortfall we had and how we were going to go responding to that loss of state general fund, where we went from $110 million down to, we're down at about $60 million now. But we'll talk a little bit more about budget issues during the deputy director's portion of our director's report. So I'm going to, as has become customary, walk through a number of issues and try to bring you up to date on a few things that are going on within the agency. I will try to respond to a few of the things that were brought up during public comment. Don't expect that I'll get to all of those. And toward the end of my remarks, I'll ask Nate Pamplin to join me here at the table to assist me with a couple of pieces. I wanted to start out with kind of an update on where we are in tribal hunting. As you know, we've had a lot of issues associated with tribal hunting. In particular, the issues associated with the Point No Point Treaty tribes, the Quileute tribe and the Macaw tribe. Issues associated with where their treaty right extends in terms from a geographic perspective. We have been encouraging those five tribes to get together and have a discussion between them to see if they can help address the outstanding issues and disagreements that they have. It is my understanding that they will be meeting at toward the end of June. I don't have a date, following that meeting, then I would expect that we would be meeting with all of those tribes to discuss the outcome of their conversations and how that might influence where we go in the future. We also had an issue associated with a boundary with the Skokomish tribe in terms of where what we were going to use to delineate their hunting area. Thanks to Michelle Culver out in Region 6, she was able to reach an agreement with the Skokomish tribe, and that particular issue has been resolved. The Point Elliott Treaty, there are nine tribes that are a part of the Point Elliott Treaty, and we have worked with all of those tribes over the course of the last 5 years or so to develop a state tribal co-management hunting agreement, and we've been fairly successful in addressing a number of the issues from geographic scope to hunting on private land, as well as coordinating our respective harvest levels. And as I think many of you know, that we partnered with a number of those tribes to help rebuild the Nooksack herd, which some may suggest we were too successful, given that we have the issues associated with damage in the Skagit Valley now as a result of that effort. We have secured an agreement for the upcoming season with seven out of the nine tribes that make up the tribes that were part of the Point Elliott Agreement, or Point Elliott Treaty. And the two outstanding tribes that have not signed to this date are the Nooksack Tribe and the Suquamish Tribe. We've had this ongoing and increasing issue associated with the geographic scope question, traditional areas that are potentially extending outside the ceded area boundaries. We've struggled with this one, to be sure. One of the first ones that came along had to do with the Medicine Creek Treaty tribes, and we entered into an agreement with them I think it's about 8 years ago now. The process by which we went to resolve the southern boundary question cost the department $40,000 because we contracted. We had an interlocal agreement with the tribes, and we contracted with two outside experts that were selected, one by us, one by them. And they came to a consensus on what we should use, and we implemented that through regulation that was promulgated through the commission process that continues to stand today. However, we have a number of other places where the Macaw tribes, the Quinault Indian Nation, the Point No Point tribes, the Upper Skagit tribe, the Muckleshoot tribe, are examples of tribes that have asserted their treaty right for hunting extends beyond their ceded area boundaries, and that has been a difficult issue for us to deal with. But we don't have staff that are qualified to review the anthropological and other historical information that would allow us to do a credible job of reviewing information that those tribes might bring forward for us to make an informed decision. Of course, all that informed decision also involves working with the county prosecutors. So very, very recently, we have contracted with the Historical Research Associates to help review information that's provided to us by the tribes supporting their assertion that traditional areas extend beyond their ceded area boundaries. In particular, to the issue associated with the Quileute tribe, the Macaw tribe, and the Point No Point, three of the four Point No Point tribes, that's the first place where we have solicited their help in reviewing the information that's been provided to us by the tribes so that we can make an informed decision based on expert opinion on where state law applies to tribal members hunting and where it's preempted as a result of a treaty right. It's not cheap, as you might imagine, but I think the investment that we're making there really is the only way that I can see to make progress on that and to make decisions that would, if challenged, be defensible in a court of law. The last piece in the tribal hunting category is the Washington Forest Practices, WFPA. Protection Association, thank you. We've had discussion headed up by Mark Domet. We've had discussions with them. They've had concerns, questions about the state tribal hunting agreements that we've entered into. And so we had an opportunity to walk through that. And I think we got to a good place of common understanding. I'm going to switch gears here and turn to the Wild Fish Conservancy steelhead lawsuit, issues associated with HGMPs, which I'll touch on in another category in a little bit more depth, and the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit that had to do with the violation of Section 9 of the Endangered Species Act and that we did not have coverage for our hatchery operations that were resulting or potentially resulting in a take of a listed species. We've met with NOAA Fisheries just this week to talk about their efforts to gear up and provide adequate staffing to review HGMPs that are being submitted by the department for review. They are adding resources to provide timely review and response to HGMP submittals. It remains, I guess we'll see as we go here how they do. But I will be talking a little bit more about HGMPs here in a minute. Commissioner Smith, Ann Larson, and myself also had an opportunity to go up and meet with Senator Erickson and Representative Bai to talk about the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit, and in particular the settlement provisions of the settlement that we entered into, and the discussion about HGMPs, timely review of those, as well as the potential of moving forward with an integrated program on the Skagit River from a hatchery perspective. Also, under the kind of under this general category, Wild Fish Conservancy recently appealed a shoreline's permit for the work that is planned at Tocco Creek Hatchery, and the finding of non-significance that came through our SEPA process. The gist of what we're trying to do there is that we have an impassable barrier there at Tocco Creek Hatchery, and we want to put in a fish bypass structure at the facility, and that's what the purpose of the project is, and that is the appeal of that shoreline permit is associated with that project. Item number three is annual co-managers meeting. We have a may recall we have a co-management stipulation that was entered into in 1997 under U.S. v. Washington, and as part of that stipulation, it requires us to have a meeting with the co-managers at minimum of once a year. We have, since we used to do that with all 20 tribes that are a part of the Bolt Case area, 5 or 6 years ago, we split that up and met with the coastal tribes separate from the Puget Sound tribes. We have one tribe, the Macaw tribe, that kind of crosses over into both areas. But we did have our meeting with our the coastal tribes within the last 10 days. I don't remember the date. We primarily reviewed the North of Falcon process, provided them an update on and some projections on the challenges that we'll be facing with the state budget. We discussed halibut management, in particular as it pertains to the International Pacific Halibut Commission expanding their surveys into Puget Sound. Particular interest was the essential fish habitat review that the Pacific Fishery Management Council is doing, proposals by Oceana and others to set aside additional areas off the Washington coast that would be closed to trawls and other types of bottom contact gear. We discussed electronic catch accounting and the we're both working on an electronic catch accounting system that would replace our paper system with our wholesale dealer's license. So we're doing some testing there. We discussed that. And we talked about at our we held our meeting with the Puget Sound tribes here just this week, and it discussed some of those issues. And in addition to that, the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan and status and progress on that, as well as reviewed our HGMP priorities. And again, I'll speak to that in just a moment. So we've completed both of those meetings, discussed a variety of items. In particular, coming out of the Puget Sound meeting, we'll be reestablishing what we call the Oversight Committee. We have a work plan that is part of our North of Falcon process, and at the end of that process, we put together a work plan that guides where we're going to focus our efforts over the next 12 months. That Oversight Committee is a key to making that reality and making progress on those. You may recall at the co-manager, that kind of co-management meeting we had back in October, that was a particular area where we thought that if we could reinvigorate that, we would make progress in some area, key areas where the co-managers have common interests. Item number four is Puget Sound Chinook steelhead management issues. I think you're all aware that we do have coverage under the Endangered Species Act for our fisheries through April 30th of 2015. That's associated with an extension provided by NOAA Fisheries for our Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan. The issues associated with developing a long-term and new plan have there's been a number of issues associated with that recently and changes in kind of our approach. And I mean recently by within the last several weeks. There, the steps to finalizing and submitting a new multi-year plan have been complicated by modeling revisions. And what that means is that we currently, in the in what we call the FRAM model, F-R-A-M, Fishery Regulation Assessment Model, is, which is how we, what we, the tool we use to evaluate management strategies measured against our conservation objectives, uses a coated wire tag base period. And that base period is comes from the late 70s and early 80s. And so if you think about all the changes that have occurred in the way we manage fisheries since that time period, using that base period, as well as changes in hatchery production and other changes in relative stock abundance, using a base period that, that is that far removed from current day, leads to having some conclusions or results come into that, out of that model that aren't representative of the stock composition that we actually might be seeing in our fisheries. So there has been a huge undertaking to try to update that base period of coated wire tags to a more recent time frame. In the more recent time frame, would be including the 2007 through 2011 kind of time frame. Once that work is completed, we'll then need to, those are all, that will all result in new inputs into the model, into the FRAM model, and they'll be needed to be tested to see whether the results are making sense or not. And then we'd be in a position to use that new model with that new base period representing stock composition, which we think will be more representative of what today's fisheries actually have in terms of impacts on stocks of concern. NOAA is telling us that from the date of submission of a final plan from the co-managers, they're going to need 18 months to review prior to the time that they would be able to issue a permit, which would be associated with a new multi-year plan. So we want to get this new base period incorporated into the model and be certain that the model will operate correctly before, and use that as the basis for evaluating the recovery exploitation rates that are representative of our conservation objectives in our Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan. We expect that that work, updating the base period, doing the testing, is going to take about another year. We're going to push that as hard as we can because we would be targeting a submittal of a new plan, multi-year plan, for June of 2015. We're going to have to do some squeezing on that 18-month time frame in order to have the new plan implemented in time for the 2017 season, which would begin May 1 of 2017. So in the interim, which is the next 2 years, we would be using the current plan. We would be requesting an extension of the current plan for a two-year period, or at least that's what we're discussing. And the advantages with doing it in this, doing it when we have the new data with the new model, would include giving us more time to engage with our constituents in terms of the content of the multi-year plan that would be submitted. And it also would result in a more accurate stock composition representation in our modeling and our assumptions that go with the plan that we ultimately submit as a multi-year plan. So if I totally confused you, let me try to summarize. We have coverage through April 30th of 2015. We would seek coverage for the next 2 years using an extension with minor modifications if needed to our current plan. We would focus our efforts over the course of the next year to update the model so it's and the base period so we can be most representative of what's going on today. Submit that plan around June of 2015. We would want them to make a final decision in time for us to be able to implement it in May of 2017. So we discussed this at length at our co-managers meeting with the Puget Sound tribes just on Wednesday of this week, when really a lot of this information coalesced so that we could have this kind of a conversation. They had a meeting with NOAA fishery representatives last Friday, a week ago today, and following our meeting that we had on Wednesday, then we'll have a small subset of the state and tribal managers meet with NOAA to go over this strategy with them and ascertain whether there are any obvious pitfalls with it. So I promised to go back to the HGMP piece. And we have submitted HGMPs previously for all of our facilities across the state. We've had to go back and revise those in some cases and bring them back to them again because, as you're aware, for example, we submitted HGMPs in 2005 for all our Chinook, our hatcheries relative to ESA-listed Chinook stocks in Puget Sound. We never got any of those approved or a response. We then had the listing of Steelhead in 2008. At that point in time, they were going to do, NIMS was going to do an EIS on all of the hatchery systems, and then the HGMPs would come in under those. That's been stalled now. They're now telling us that that might take an additional 4 years to complete. So we're back to needing to get the HGMPs approved in advance, or obviously well in advance of the EIS process. We have, as part of our wild fish settlement, an agreement to not sue on any of our Puget Sound hatcheries for 2.5 years. So that's an obvious window of opportunity that we're working within. The other consideration is part of the settlement is that we would not release early hatcheries with early winter chambers broodstock unless and until we had an HGMP approved, with the exception of the Skykomish, where we have 180,000 fish that we can release, are released, and we can do that for next year as well. So given that we have all these hatchery facilities and we have these HGMPs that have been submitted to NOAA, the last instructions, if I can call them that, that the co-managers gave NOAA is, we want you to process those HGMPs on a first-in, first-out basis. Given what's transpired with the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit and the settlement, given that our steelhead HGMPs have been revised and submitted and are essentially at the back of that line, we needed to gain agreement with the co-managers to give different instructions from the co-managers to NIMS as far as what our priorities were. That was a part of our discussion on Wednesday. As a result of that discussion, we will be submitting a letter. I'm pretty sure we're going to do it in written form. We're working out the details in terms of our HGMP priorities. And the first priority would be to complete the Dungeness salmon programs and the Snohomish salmon programs. Those are, we think those are pretty straightforward. And shouldn't take a lot of time. Want to get those done. The second priority would be for the early winter steelhead programs, tribal Chinook and steelhead programs. So that suite of facilities that have those programs would be the second tier, and then the third tier is the remainder of the Puget Sound programs. So we reached that agreement with the tribes on Wednesday. We'll be communicating that to National Marine Fisheries Service, which will result in a recompilation of the list. Our next steps then is to compile that list of specific HGMPs in Tier 1 and Tier 2, meet with NOAA to discuss our proposed prioritization and schedule for review, and then send NOAA a letter with the co-manager's prioritization and a request for schedule for completing ESA reviews of the HGMPs. So I want to get these early winter program HGMPs completed so we don't lose our ability to release fish next year. Topic number 5, Deschutes Watershed Project Update.
Commissioner Holtzman.
Sorry. Sorry. Hatchery genetic management plans.
Is that just unique to Puget Sound, or where do we stand in our part of the world? Because I've got mixed messages when I've asked this question.
It is not unique to Puget Sound. It is applicable across the state. We have HGMPs submitted on 114 HGMPs has been submitted. Jim, if I'm wrong on that number, kick me, would you? I believe it's 114 HGMPs. Out of that, we have revised about 70 of them and resubmitted them, and there have been 14 that have been approved. And I'm close on the numbers. Don't put it in the newspaper in case I need to take. I've got the numbers over there. Jim's got the numbers. I'm darn close. 122 programs, 71 instead of 70 have been resubmitted, and we have 14 approved. The difference in the Columbia River system is that they're making progress a lot quicker on the EIS, and so the EIS is going to give us the coverage that we need there, and so we're in a different place in terms of risk. Not to say that the HGMPs and approval aren't important, but we're in a bit of a different place in on the Columbia River and those hatchery systems than we are in Puget Sound.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions on the HGMP piece before I... Okay. So item five is the Deschutes Watershed...
Excuse me. Commissioner Mencken.
Yeah, the question that gets asked from time to time, more frequently these days, is what is taking NOAA so long to process an HGMP?
Well, I don't think it's appropriate for me to answer why NOAA, another agency, is taking a long time to do a project, to be honest. I do know that they have an extremely small number of staff assigned to that project, as in one, and they are remedying that by adding additional staff, like up to four. And I think the other piece was there was a change in course from reviewing and approving HGMPs as a mechanism to first doing the EIS and then having the HGMPs follow them, and then with all the legal challenges that we've faced, the LWA is another classic example that followed the exact same path that we did with the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit on our facilities, where the tribe stopped releasing early winter steelhead. They went the same direction we did. So as these lawsuits have come along and the time that it's projected to take to complete the EIS process, they've had to change course again to get coverage so we can get out from under the legal liabilities associated with not having HGMPs and have these facilities permitted.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other on the HGMP?
Yeah. Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, I've also been asked that same question about why NMFS is so slow, and you've explained it going from one to four, but it just seems as though I guess I'm going to ask the question, what can stakeholders do to pressure NOAA to get on this in a more expeditious manner, because this is really, really difficult for people to grasp.
Well, I know that our congressional, several of our congressional members have heard, and we've conveyed to them the concern there, and they've heard from their constituents, and they have responded by communicating with NOAA their extreme concern and their expectation that they provide the necessary resources. I know that there are certainly several state legislators that have done the same thing in response to their own concern, as well as those expressed to them by their constituents. So I will say, just when this all, as this unfolded, and um, you know, the 60-day notice came out in February, first part of February. As we went through this, there was an I made the decision. I'm not gonna get into the blame. It does no good to get into the blame game, and there's fault to be found in a number of places. I get that, including here. But I told Noah that I was not going to get into that, and I wanted us, for us, we were going to focus on solving this problem and put all our energies into solving the problem. So,
okay, that's good.
Commissioner Smith.
And I do think it's fair to say that in a climate of the last few years of which everybody is clamoring for reduction of government at all levels, this is a fallout. This is part of a fallout of it, that NOAA has had a budget cut and a budget cut again. So, again, there's no excuse, but when you reduce the size of any budget, you do face consequences, and that's the reality.
Yeah, I don't want to make excuses for them or us. I just want to get it fixed.
Yeah.
So,
good. Commissioner Carpenter?
So are you then comfortable with their participation in trying to expedite these? I mean, is your interaction with them in a positive manner going forward with getting these HCMPs wrapped up?
We have a strong, healthy working relationship with NOAA Fisheries at pretty much all levels.
Okay.
And we're going to continue to put as much pressure as we can and offer whatever assistance we can to get the job done.
Thank you.
I do have a question. Going back to the Puget Sound Chinook Management Plan, Chinook Harvest Management Plan, are there any, you can't be very specific about this, but are there any legal vulnerabilities related to our request for extension in the coming 2 years? Could we, in other words, if we've already acknowledged that our model is probably based on the wrong base period, does that raise the potential for us getting sued or NOAA getting sued for issuing a permit to us, an extended permit?
Well, first of all, we have not acknowledged in any way that our model is not accurately estimating impacts on listed stocks, but what we are saying is that we want to improve it and make sure that the accuracy is as good as we can get it. So I don't want anybody to think that we've somehow admitted that we're not doing the best with what we have.
Okay.
But at the same time, understanding that we're going to make every bit of effort we can to make sure that we're accurately estimating impacts on listed stocks so that we can manage appropriately.
And do you foresee any?
And as far as the legal liability, is that if we don't get, we have to have that permit to have fisheries. So if we were to not get that permit and then authorize fisheries, there would definitely be a legal liability. So we're in active conversations with NOAA about this approach in terms of using our current plan as a means to have coverage while we make improvements to our models, and which will also improve the product that we give them to review as far as an updated multi-year plan.
Okay. Well, I know there's been a lot of conversations in the past about how we get to that multi-year plan so we don't have to keep going into this every single year. So it looks like it's on the horizon, but not for another couple years.
Well, we did have one, of course, that expired last year, and we extended that last multi-year plan. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
But okay. Anything else on that? As a reminder, I'm on item 5, and I have 15. So.
Okay. It's our fault.
I know, Tammy, you're loving it. The Chutes Watershed Project, just an update. There's two parts. There's a Tumwater Falls facility, which is we have $6 million. There's an interpretive center there, but it's primarily updating and putting in new holding and abatement ponds. The design work is currently projected to be completed by November of 2014. Permits and real estate actions, the lease agreements completed by February of 2015, and we would award the construction contract in early 2015 with an estimated completion date of the spring of 2016. The second piece of that is where the new hatchery would be located at Pioneer Park. It hasn't been funded yet, but we did get some funding thanks to a lot of help from some of the folks that are here with us today on both these pieces. We were provided $1.3 million to begin the pre-design, permitting, real estate, and real estate actions. This work will be followed by well development, as in water, and trails in 2015. We will submit a capital budget request for the Hatchery Construction Fund in our FY15-17 10-year capital budget plan. Item 6, Sinlahican 75th anniversary celebration. As Commissioner Caney mentioned, we'd had a great event over there. We're celebrating the first piece of property that was acquired using Pittman Robertson dollars for land conservation. We were really fortunate to be joined by Director Dan Ash, who was out from Washington, D.C., from Director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Also had our past Commissioner Chuck Perry there with us. And as part of the celebration, we also dedicated the trail there to Dave Bertel. So it was a cool event. Next is wanted to make you aware that we were honored by the Forterra. Us along with the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Ecology, we were provided and awarded a Conservation Game Changer Award. There were about 1,600 people there as part of that event, with some other things happening too, of course. But it was for our role in the acquisition of the Tiana Way project, the 50,000 acre acquisition, where we have a very, very significant management role in the future. So that was a nice event. Item 8 is a federal budget update. As most of you know, in late April, Jennifer Kwan and I traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with members of Congress, partner organizations, and members of the Obama administration, including Sam Rausch, who's the deputy from NOAA Fisheries, Director Dan Ash from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Director John Jarvis from National Park Service. We currently benefit from solid relations with delegation offices, where we found strong support. However, limitations remain in available federal funds. Our letter that was sent to our delegation earlier this year that was signed by over 30 individuals and organizations was well received, and it demonstrated the regional solidarity around these important funding issues and activities that those funds support. The federal 2014 funding is materializing at state level. We continue to be concerned about the funding declines in the Department of Commerce budget and an apparent backing away from federal obligations, Mitchell Act, funding Pacific Salmon Treaty implementation, those kinds of activities. A few particular points of significance relative to 2014. Mitchell Act funding continues to decline, and DFW will experience shortfalls in operating and marking funding, amounting to about a $1 million reduction in FY14, federal fiscal 14. About $550,000 of that is for operation and maintenance, which is another word for its production, and another $500,000 in marking monies that came from the hatchery reform component of Mitchell Act funding. Hatchery reform, science, sampling, project needs did not receive any funding this year. That's compared to $3.7 million we got last year in 13. And we are currently evaluating a mix of cuts in production and staffing, as well as the use of carry forward funds to make up a portion of the shortfall. The 15 federal budget is still in development, and the political reality makes it likely that a final budget won't be completed until after the elections, probably sometime in January. We are currently tracking developments in the Commerce budget. The House Commerce budget passed, and the Senate budget will be heard on the Senate floor next week. A particular note is that both House and Senate Commerce budget currently include $65 million for PACSERV, Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund, thanks to Representative Herrera Butler and Senator Murray for moving this from its original mark, which was at $50 million. And you may recall that the state of Washington gets about $24 to $25 million out of the 65. The majority of that goes to habitat restoration projects. There's about $5 to $6 million that comes to the tribes in the state of that. About $2 million comes to the department, and the majority of that money has been used for marking Puget Sound hatchery production. So the priorities of the use of that fund would suggest that if it was cut, one of the first places to feel that would be the money that comes to DFW, which would impact our ability to mark our hatchery fish in Puget Sound. Relative to the, there's a category called salmon management, and it includes both Mitchell Act and Pacific Salmon Treaty funding, and that's in the Commerce budget. Pacific Salmon Treaty is funded from three different sources: Commerce, State, and Interior. So I'm talking about the Commerce piece. Both the House and the Senate rejected the President's proposal to cut that funding, which was directed at Mitchell Act, that was in the President's budget, by $3 million. While we may be lucky to avoid this cut, the proposed funding levels are likely insufficient, and we will see impacts to DFW operations in Mitchell Act, as well as our Pacific Salmon Treaty, and our ability to adequately prepare and staff the upcoming renegotiations of certain aspects of the treaty, such as the Chinook Annex that expires in 2014. And I've called this to your attention before, but we have multiple sources that make up our ability to mark our hatchery fish: Mitchell Act, PACSERV, General Fund. And from a monitoring and sampling perspective, Pacific Salmon Treaty, the money that comes out of the coated wire tag improvement piece that's expiring at this year. So there's a number of budget concerns in the federal arena that could impact us in a negative way. Next item is just wanted to call to your attention that there's a provision under U.S. v. Washington that if parties were going to start, prior to the party starting a sub-proceeding under U.S. v. Washington, they have to go through a process called a meet and confer. And there was a request to meet and confer by the Skokomish tribe. The meet and confer was in relationship to their desire to be designated as a self-regulating tribe. There are three tribes that have got self-regulatory status. There were two at the time of U.S. when the Bolt decision came down, and that was the Yakima Nation and the Quinault Indian Nation. The Quileute tribe got self-regulating status. I don't remember the year, but about 1999. There is a procedure within USV Washington that allows a tribe to gain self-regulatory status. They can either get it by making a request to the Department of Fisheries, which now is the Department of Fish and Wildlife, or they can go to court and ask the court to give them that status. That didn't work. So there's steps to go through the meet and confer. There's about 8 different steps, including is the issue a technical one that would be applicable to the Fishery Advisory Board? Is there an opportunity to mediate the issue or settle the issue? So we went through those steps. There were in the neighborhood of about 10 other tribes represented at the meet and confer. There are prescribed steps also in USV Washington for us to follow if we get a request from a tribe to gain self-regulating status. And so we're going to request by letter information that's associated with those steps, and then either meet with them again or make a decision based on the information that they provide us as it matches up with the procedures that are provided in USV Washington. The so what of all this, I guess, is we have essentially gone to a method through co-management of self-regulation by the tribes. The tribes, of course, since the time of the Bolt decision, have increased their capacity from a fishery management perspective, technical folks, the establishment of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, the technical staff that supports the tribes from that joint commission. They're now promulgating regulations for their fisheries. We are not. Initially it was assumed that the state would be promulgating regulation authorizing tribal fisheries, the same thing that we currently do under USV Oregon with the Columbia River tribes, much different model in Puget Sound. So that was a big part of our discussion, is the so what, given that we're essentially, turning to the tribes to implement and promulgate their own regulations pursuant to harvest management agreements that are derived through the North Falcon process, what are you looking to gain? And it was just more of a represented as a stature, status kind of, it's what their primary basis was for the request. So I wanted you to be aware of that. Tammy, can you help me get this up and running? I know we had public testimony on the Cowlitz net pens, and as it was mentioned, these did become operational after a lot of work with a lot of different entities. So this is obviously a picture of the net pens that were put in. The production of fall Chinook then was increased from 1.5 million up to 3.5 million by placing these net pens in. Greatly appreciate the support that we got from stakeholders. Never would have happened without them. There was substantial permitting involved to make this a reality, from working with Tacoma Power through the FERC license piece, HPA, Lewis County, as well as coordinating with NOAA and Cowlitz Fisheries Technical Committee to get the necessary permits. This did delay the release of the fish into the net pens, as was talked about during the testimony. And we didn't get the fish into the pens as early as we'd hoped. But you know, the positive side is that we're optimistic that this is going to, this increased production is going to result in an enhanced fishing opportunity, and we're hoping that this facility, that we can use this to augment the fishing opportunity that we're able to provide in the future. And so I mean, understanding that there's concern that they're only going to be in there for a short period of time, not as long as we had hoped. At the same time, there was, I know that we put a lot of effort to try to get this done as quickly as we could, but there were a lot of hurdles to jump. So no excuses, but great outcome, I think, and looking forward to seeing what kind of returns we get.
Could I ask a question? If you are you finished with that?
Yes.
Report. Okay. So that's good news. You expect it to continue into the future. Is there an ongoing source of funding, or do we have to go back to the legislature every year or 2 years to get funding for that program?
To the best of my knowledge, I'm not even going to try to guess. I think we're going to need to continue to go back and get this as a solid, established reoccurring fund source, but I think that's the case.
And was there a research side to this planting project that was going to look at the beneficial effects of the net pen?
Yeah, we're trying to. I mean, one of the problems that we've had is the low adult survival rates for fish coming out of the hatcheries, and so one of the ideas behind this net pen project was to try to raise these fish and get them in the lake, get them imprinted there, try to increase our survival rates on our hatchery fish. So, you know, while if that proves out to be successful, then rather than, you know, if we'd put these 2 million in the hatchery and we'd had a lower survival rate by putting them here, and if we can get a higher survival rate, it's going to, you know, proportionally have a much better result. So you don't have to have much of an increase in survival rate when you're releasing 2.5 million fish. I mean, the difference between 0.8% and 1% can be a lot of fish coming back. So,
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know where Mayfield Lake is, but I don't know a lot about it. Is there a natural outflow, or do these fish have to be recaptured and released downstream?
I'd have to ask, have Jim help me answer that question.
I'm going to do it right now. Maybe later. I just was wondering for my own.
Jim, can you? I know we're using up a lot of time, but
we have flexibility towards the end of the day. We're going to be a little late through the day, looks like.
Did you hear my question, Jim?
I did. Jim Scott, Fish Program. Thank you, Commissioner Carpenter. There is a dam, obviously, Mayfield Dam, and the way the program is set up to work now is that we will, as Mr. LeDuc said, collect the fish from the pens as juveniles, probably about the start of July. We will transport those to a holding site below the dam and then release them from that site. And then when the adults come back 4 years from now, they come to what's called a barrier dam just below Mayfield Lake. And at that point, we'll be able to collect them. And, you know, a big part of this experiment, again, is to see how well those fish perform relative to the fish that were released on station at the Cowlett Salmon Hatchery. So it's, I think it's a good step for us. As Director Anderson said, we did encounter some challenges in getting the necessary permits, but we're looking forward to running this program for many years.
Thank you.
So the next topic is a Wanapum Dam update. So as you're all aware, the Wanapum Dam so-called incident has had challenges on many fronts, but is now what we consider in a managed status. Current Wanapum pool level is still below normal operating levels. It's being held at 541 to 545 feet. The normal pool level is 562. And is also 562 is also the minimum for adult passage to work normally as designed. And of course, you know that we've got a temporary has got a temporary fix in place. The Rock Island Dam may be impacted later in the summer when there's a potential for dewatered fish ladder entrances that would become a problem. There's a temporary fix now created for that eventuality. Repairing the dam, it's, you recall, it's a 2-inch wide by 65-foot long crack in Monolith 4 or Spillway 4. Grant County PUD now knows that the fracture has its roots in a mathematical error from initial design, and the rest of the spillways suffer from the same problem. They're in the process of drilling multiple 10-inch holes, first in the damaged structure, then in all the remaining undamaged spillways in order to insert steel tendons that will be secured in the bedrock. They expect to take this to take until at least late October 2014 at the earliest, and to a point where they have sufficient work done where they can begin bringing the pool up to minimum operational level while that work continues. At Grant County PUD's request, and in seeing the need to protect public safety and resources, the agency passed an emergency WAC, closing the areas along the beaches that are immediately below the dam. We've posted areas to notify the public and put out press releases to inform the public about that regulation, and we also obtained a funded contract from Grant PUD for officers to patrol the area by boat. Had really good compliance from the public, and their and violations are now quite rare. On the fish passage piece, Grant County PUD installed two adult anadromous fish passage modifications to their Wanapum ladders, each consisting of diesel pumps to water the ladder and water slide chute at the top and direct the fish into a pool. Trap and haul was suspended shortly after their high conversion rates of radio tagged fish from the ladders making it through the project. In normal times, Chelan PUD completed extension of two of their three fish ladders entrances on Rock Island Dam. Juvenile passage does not appear to be a concern, and fish and habitat staff from the department are working with Grant PUD and their contractors to evaluate and monitor resident fish and freshwater shellfish issues in the pool. The irrigation concerns with the lower pool have all been addressed. All known irrigation water access problems have been fixed. Pumps have been screened, and all permit processes were streamlined to keep the agricultural growers going. Obviously, this whole thing has been a big time absorbing project for our folks, particularly from Region 2. It will likely continue to be as such, and thus far as we've only been compensated for the enforcement efforts that we've had. This is a couple of pictures of an additional device that was put in to try to lessen the impact on the fish that are going through these fish ladders and being put into the lower part of the river by taking them through this almost looks like a turbocharger. It helps direct the fish as they're all kind of going in nose first instead of in different contortions of how they might be going in, and it also significantly reduces the drop that the fish have to endure before they get down into the next part, into the pool below. So another example of Grant PUD really stepping up and going the extra mile to try to minimize the impact on fish. I'm going to turn now to wolves. Since the last commission meeting, we've documented two mortalities of radio-collared wolves. One was on April 21st. It was confirmed that the breeding male of the smackout pack was killed by a cougar. And then on April 19th, a female from the ruby pack was killed as a result of being hit by a car. You may remember the female that we collared and we spayed that had been mixed up with a domestic dog that happened to be that same animal. We did initiate ground trapping efforts in late July. Biologists did capture a yearling female in the lookout pack and fitted her with a collar. Trapping efforts are shifting to other areas, including Carpenter Ridge and the Dirty Shirt packs, those ones that we haven't been able to confirm yet, but we suspect. In addition to ground trapping, extensive effort has been placed on looking for wolf activity sign, particularly in the wedge and the smack out areas. Since the last commission meeting, staff have investigated 8 potential wolf depredation calls. None of the calls were classified as wolf. 6 were classified as non-wolf, other predators, things. 1 was classified as unknown cause of mortality, and 1 report we couldn't determine. They reported the loss 2 weeks after the actual incident occurred, so there wasn't much left to look at. We're continuing to work with livestock producers on a local level to renew and participate in livestock damage prevention agreements. To date, we've got 33 of those in place. Conflict specialists are continuing to assist WSU students with field activity logistics and provided range riders for the respective field projects associated with WSU's research on minimizing and mitigating wolf-livestock conflicts in Washington. So that's an important project. We also, as I reported last time, began construction of a carcass compost facility at the Sherman Creek Wildlife Management Area. That's one of the things that we saw when we visited Montana and saw what they had worked out with their Department of Transportation. We expect a pilot project facility up and operational by August 1. We've also had some questions regarding the interpretation of the reported wolf population growth rate in Washington. In the letter dated March 27, 2014, from myself to the director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the department stated that observed annual growth rate of wolves in Washington was 39% between 2008 and 2013. And one of the concerns was that 39% wasn't representative of the most recent year, which certainly is true. We took the minimum count that we had from 2008, 2009 up through 2013, calculated the average growth rate, which is where the 39% came from. But there is a significant variation in the growth rate from year to year. It was 20% in 2009. It was as high as 89% in 2012 and dropped all the way down to 0.02%. In 2013, we just went from the minimum count of the actual number of animals observed only went up by 1 from 51 to 52 animals. So while I believe we characterized the growth rate for that time period correctly, I think there's concern that is continuing to occur, and that has also been observed in most recent years, and we take that criticism to heart. I thought I'd speak to the petition from the Consortium of Conservation Groups requesting the Commission to modify or to codify in WAC sections of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan. The petition is similar to the one received back in July 19th of 2013. In response last July, the Department offered to use the agency's Citizen Member Wolf Advisory Group as a stakeholder process for consideration of potentially codifying portions of the plan. In December 2013, the conservation groups who initiated the petition briefed the advisory group on the request. It's been discussed at what is being characterized at length, and the department indicated it would initiate rulemaking for some components of the Wolf Plan. You may recall that in the end of the beginning of October in 2013, the Fish and Wildlife Commission amended 8 rules and adopted 1 new rule associated with the Wolf Plan and wolf livestock conflict. Then again on May 21st, 2014, we filed a CR-101 initiating additional rulemaking codifying portions of the plan. The rulemaking will include a public hearing that you'll have at your August 8th and 9th meeting with potential action adoption in September. In terms of the most recent petition, we are currently working with the AG's office to understand the options the commission might consider and how the rulemaking process already initiated on this might factor into that thinking. Getting close to the end here. Did want to speak to some of the efforts we've been making relative to community outreach, publicizing activities that are being provided as a result of our work. Yesterday, we launched a new centralized website with information about several important advisory committees and management boards. So for the first time, the department has a central place online where the public can go to learn about the various groups and get meeting schedules, agendas, and background on the issues. We've got a relatively small subset of the advisory groups up on there so far. There's about 8 on there, including the Elk Hoof Disease Working Group, Master Hunters, Puget Sound Recreational Enhancement Fund Oversight Committee, Wolf Advisory Group, along with a few others. But we're looking to expand that so that we have a place where people can go and readily see what's going on and how they might interact with those activities. Promotions, we had the free fishing weekend where you didn't have to have you got a free fishing license last weekend, as well as we got Father's Day coming up day after tomorrow. So we've had promotions on both of those. We've had news releases, coverages in our Weekender Recreation Report, social media postings on both Facebook and Twitter. And we've sent out email messages to target a group of anglers. So just a lot of work to try to promote those things. And lastly, I think you know that our public request staff is located within the Public Information Office, and we're on pace to set a new record in responding to public records requests. When you look back at 2005, we had 360. That had gone up to 648 by last year, so from 360 to 648. We're on pace, if it continues, to get to over 800 this year. So, and we've added staff members. We used to have just one person, but we've added staff people within the Public Information Office, as well as each program, fish program, wildlife program, in particular habitat program, have added staff to work with those. So we're making a substantial investment in staff to respond to those requests within the legal requirements that we have, and we also want to try to be as responsive as we can be. 2 more to go. I wanted to talk a little bit about treaty and non-treaty allocation in Puget Sound. There's been some increased focus on that in recent weeks and days. And while I can't possibly do the issue justice, nor should I necessarily try in this forum. We recognize that we need to have conversations with our customers, our stakeholders, our advisors on this issue. I did want to give you just a quick kind of perspective. Allocation in Puget Sound is prescribed in the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan. That document was put together, I believe, in 1985. And it describes the, you may recall that Judge Bold held that allocation is, you allocate wild and hatchery fish, you combine the numbers, you don't do them separately. And in the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan, which was entered as a court order, you do it by region. So there's, I think there's five regions in Puget Sound. I can get that number for you. So when we go through our North of Falcon process, we produce a table that is available to anyone that wants it, that shows that it looks like this. And there are six allocation units so that you can look at treaty, non-treaty sharing. You can both look at wild and natural origin fish, and you look at by those regions. Of course, since the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan came along, we've had the listing of Puget Sound Chinook. And so, and we've changed our management dramatically since 1985-86 timeframe, where weak stock management really is driving our management approach, and frankly, appropriately so. So, this issue about how you share the conservation burden for the weakest stock has also been kind of overlaid on top of this allocation of looking at these six different regions, combining wild and hatchery fish, divide by two and see where you are. And I'm just going to speak, this is just speaking to Chinook. There's another conversation to have with Coho, and another one to have with Chum, and probably another one to have with Pink, and another one to have with Sockeye. But I'm focusing on Chinook. So if you think about the sharing of the conservation burden, one way to look at that is what proportion of the limiting stock is taken in non-treaty versus treaty fisheries. And in 8 out of the last 10 years, the non-treaty fishery was allocated more than 50% of the harvest of the weakest stock in Puget Sound. Two of those years, that wasn't the case. One of those was this year, where the tribes are projected to take more than 50% of the weakest stock. And the final model run estimates for the non-treaty fishery projects that the non-treaty fishery is going to take 26.2% of the weakest stock, which is Lake Washington natural origin fish, and the tribe is going to take the balance. Put that into some context, 26.2% equates to 52 fish, and I don't know if I can do the math on the fly, but the 74% or so equates to 146 fish, and most of those are going to be taken in a CNS fishery. So from a conservation perspective, if you look at that and you look at how where the weakest stock and how, I mean, that's one way to look at that. There are other ways, I'm sure. The other is looking at it from the legal perspective, and that has to do with the allocation units that are prescribed in the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan. So again, I'm looking at 2014, and we've got graphs that go back into history and the numbers, and we can talk about those in some more detail at a later time, but so the overall hatchery plus wild, the projected sharing of Chinook in the final 2004 model run is 58% for the tribes and 42% for the state. And that's readily displayed on this table that's available on our website. It's available to the participants in North Falcon. Now, I just wanted to speak briefly about the reason for the imbalance as I have looked at this carefully. And one of the primary reasons there is this imbalance is the strength of the George Adams and Hoodsport hatchery programs. If you look at the tribes, Primarily, the Skokomish tribe are projected to catch 45,511 fish in the Bays of Hood. The vast majority is going to be taken in the terminal area. This represents 42% of the total tribal Chinook harvest in Puget Sound. So out of what's projected to be 107,770 fish to be taken by the tribes, 42% of that is going to be taken right there in the Bays of Hood Canal. The three South Sound tribes are projected to take 36% of the total of 107,000. Those four tribes, which not surprisingly is where our strongest hatchery systems are that are producing Chinook, and they're fishing in the terminal area after those fish have left they're not taking them in the open marine water areas like Strait of Juan de Fuca or Area 9 or 10 or those kinds of things. So if you want to remedy that imbalance, we open to talking about how to do that. But there's not too many choices as to how do you go about remedying the imbalance. And the remedy is to put more of our non-treaty fisheries in the terminal area where we can catch more hatchery fish for every ESA impact than we can out in the marine waters. We'd have to shift our impacts from where they are now, it's a zero-sum game, to those terminal areas. From my perspective, that'd be a radical change. It would be inconsistent with our harvest objectives, which what drives our management is our harvest objectives. And those are led by a recreational priority for Chinook and Puget Sound. I mean, that our harvest objective is to create as much recreational opportunity as we can in Puget Sound for Chinook. So I'm anxious. I know this is an issue. I'm anxious to talk to people about it. I've got more graphs and data that we can all look at and share. And I'm anxious to have that conversation. Before I go to the last item, which I'm going to ask Nate to come up and help me with, which is the update on the hoof disease piece. I'm proud to be a part of the department. I'm proud to work with some really great people. We work really hard, and we're anxious to have conversations with anyone and everyone. And those that criticize us, we're anxious to talk about those issues and see if we can make progress so that we can be united. Because when I look at the budget problems coming, and we potentially are going to get a request to do a 15% GFS budget cut. We haven't got those yet. But that's $11 million for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we put that on top of the federal budget pieces. And we've got to be together. We have got to be together, or we're going to all get killed. We're not gonna succeed. So I'm anxious to form that coalition and to work through the issues that we have. I know that I'm going to work with members of the commission to set that opportunity up. And we're committed to doing that. So last topic is hoof disease. And I've got some notes here and some reports on the work of we've got two advisory groups, the technical advisory group as well as the public working group. And what I don't want to do, which I was going to do, is I heard the testimony here today, and I don't want to do a point counterpoint. It would not be productive. I heard their concerns about really two. Well, there maybe three. There's a bunch, but public health and safety is one. The potential impacts of herbicides from two different perspectives, really. What is that? Does that impact the public health issues associated with eating elk meat taken from those areas where those herbicides are applied? And the other one is the live animal research activities that I've had a chance to talk. I know I've had a chance to talk with both Mark and Bruce about that in the past. So rather than, they have an interpretation that's a little bit different than what I've been given about the results of the TAG conversations. I don't think it's productive to try to go into those right now. But so I just wanted to ask Nate to speak to a couple of those points.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director Anderson. So given that we're going to be providing a comprehensive hoof disease update to you in August, so we'll walk through the status of the investigations and some of the management options. And that's where we're really at. We're wrapping up our diagnostic efforts. Our TAG had come to consensus that they thought this was associated with an infectious disease, one of which is the body of evidence indicates it's a disease that's a treponeme associated called contagious ovine digital dermatitis, which is found in domestic sheep. And so we're transitioning to some of the management options. And kind of use the analogy, this particular disease is not a cancer, but I want to use cancer as just an analogy. We don't know the cause of prostate cancer. We don't know the cause of ovarian cancer. But we start to move on to intervention and management of those diseases. And that's kind of where we're transitioning now with hoof disease. So just thought that analogy might be helpful. Specific to public health and safety, and I want to go back a little bit because there was been different questions that have been raised about that and our timing of the different investigations that we've done. When we initially did collections of elk back in 2009, we ended up doing full necropsies of those animals, and we did not know. I mean, the reports were coming out in 2008. We did not know what was causing this particular malady. And so while we did all the tissue samples, at the time, the animals, the remaining parts of the animals were disposed of. Since then, we had looked at a variety of tissues. We're seeing that the disease is contained to the hoof. And so that was on a travesty that this disease is. One relief here that you kind of appreciate a little bit of good news, and that is that the disease is limited to the hoof, and so that the muscle, i.e., the meat, was not contaminated with this disease. And similarly, when domestic livestock that have hoof disease, that meat enters into the U.S. meat market. And so it was a relief on our end. We've worked with the Department of Health to come up with a fact sheet. It's a common question that we get, but know that bacterial disease is not in those other tissues. And we always counsel, it doesn't matter if you're harvesting birds and, is there avian influenza or West Nile virus or other types of disease, use good handling practices when you're processing your game animal, and we're not in a position to license or certify the quality of meat, but we can say with a lot of confidence that this disease is not associated with infecting the meat. So, there was some questions about herbicides and maybe just walk through a couple elements. We've heard primarily kind of three suggestions on how herbicides could compound this issue. The first was, are herbicides causing the direct toxicant causing the reaction in the hoof? We've done histopathology i.e. taking very thinly sliced sections of tissue and looking at the response of cells at the cellular level, we're not seeing a response of a toxicant. We're seeing a response of an infectious bacteria. Second would be, well, are herbicides causing immunosuppression? I.e. the immune system is degraded, and thus this is what's allowing for bacteria coming in. We're not seeing other diseases in these afflicted elk, so that's one sign. Another is that we look at toxicological studies in laboratory, and at extremely high doses on some of these chemicals, it can result in immunosuppressants. And so folks are kind of making that as, this is the connection. I think it's important to acknowledge that we have not seen any direct effects, direct toxic effects to mammals from herbicides. EPA lists some of these herbicides as practically non-toxic. That's not a term we've coined. That's an EPA term. And then also thinking about how elk forage. It's not in a lab setting where this is the only chemical that is provided to try to look at the lethality, if that's a word I'm looking at. Commissioner Smith for some help here from the EPA, but looking for the testicity if this is lethal, and so contrast that with animals foraging in the wild where here's a clear cut that's been sprayed by herbicides. This isn't the only area where elk would be feeding. It's already very much diluted compared to what would it take probably in a lab setting to cause a reaction in small mammals. There's other forage available, and it's not spread over, it's spread to that area, not over a larger broadcasted area. So when we kind of look at those level of items, we're not seeing herbicides being a pathway into the system. We asked about, well, why don't we look for herbicides or their metabolites? Well, because there hasn't been a connection between herbicides and toxic effects in mammals, there really isn't lab tests that we could go to that would be able to say, yep, this is how you would study these different metabolites. And then third, certainly the concern about, well, the herbicide spraying could reduce the forage base, and therefore that's having an effect on elk. It could be. And so that's that broader ecological effect, and that's one of the studies that we're doing with black-tailed deer and University of Alberta is looking at the forage availability. But I want to contrast that the toxicological impacts of the herbicides versus the nutrition availability component. And we're not seeing that this disease is associated with nutrition, toxicants. There was a question about the live animal testing. This had been raised for a number of years, and Mr. Smith has championed that we do that. The types of tests that we were working with our vet and research team, they're incredibly invasive, and it requires euthanizing, sampling the animal, and taking a whole battery of samples and tests that were run, literally drilling small holes in the hooves and extracting different tissue samples to do the histopathology as well as to culture for different bacteria. But that was that phase of the diagnostic research. We also have, if this is what our team thinks it is, if it is associated with the infectious bacteria associated with, for instance, domestic sheep, we can also use domestic livestock as a surrogate. And they've been doing this work. Livestock industry has been doing this work for 30 years. And so we have that as a surrogate for us to be able to draw upon. We also understand that, if we're looking at, depending on the research question that live animal testing would be, we might be able to simply, if it's looking at population dynamics or survival or calving, that can be done by applying collars and tracking the fate of those animals without having the added burden and expense of keeping animals in captivity. But there is value now that the research continues to advance, new management-driven questions are opened up about where could live animal testing help in answering some of those questions. One question would be, what's the vector of this infectious disease? How is it? Is it hoof to hoof? Is it stepping in the soil? You know, those types of questions, I think, have merit with live animal testing, and we'll be looking for counsel from our technical advisory group to understand where that comes into play. So I hope that answered some of the questions.
Commissioner Kehoe?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're running late, but I wanted to follow up on the herbicide issue. You know, I'm not an expert. My sense is, though, is that herbicides have been used for some period of time in the clear-cut areas. Is that a fair statement? I mean, this isn't a new phenomenon, or is it? Okay, and so we do have, and the first observation of this phenomenon, disease was 2008, 2009, is that right?
For this particular malady, yes, sir.
Yeah, so, and I heard comment in the public testimony about Agent Orange. you know, where this is not Agent Orange, I'm quite certain, I'm sure my friend at the colleague and commissioner at EPA would verify that we're not using Agent Orange. out there. You know, I don't mean to...
Chairman, no. This is no joke. This is no joke. This is nothing to laugh at.
I'm not laughing.
You were laughing and they were laughing. You guys got to wake up and see the stars. You're not seeing the actual thing that's going on in this place.
Okay. Sir, you had your opportunity for public comment,
well,
and
laugh.
We are not.
You did laugh. All of you did.
Madam Chairman, I didn't mean to belittle the comment or make light of it. However, I did comment on it, and that's the way I feel, is that we're not using Agent Orange. The use of herbicides, my understanding, has been going on for some period of time. This, to me, and I'm not a scientist, but this sounds like a very, very complex issue, and people are frustrated, obviously, that there's been no kind of smoking gun here yet. And any of it, I just wanted to touch on that, on the issue about herbicides and its role or maybe not role in this whole situation. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else? What should we do about the budget discussion? We're way behind schedule. Can we take a break and then we'll figure out Deputy Director Store?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I mean, it's your choice. There's not a lot of new news since the conference call. You were interested in thoughts about next steps, so I have a few more slides there. Probably 15 minutes if you want to hear it. If not, we could do it at another time.
Could we do it tomorrow?
We could do it tomorrow.
Okay, let's do it tomorrow then. Thank you.